And we rally back to Unchanged. It's Monday, April 29th, 2024. This is Overtime. I'm your host, Chris Vecchio, the man in orange, Ilya Spivak, the man in blue, Thomas Westwater today, Dylan Radigan-Zal, he'll be back with us again soon. Gentlemen, it's the start of a busy macro and earnings week. Apple, Amazon earnings around the corner. We're also going to have a Fed meeting, Treasury refunding announcement details, non-farm payrolls report. To wrap it all up on Friday, we are not out of the woods just yet. This rally that we've seen in the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, and the Russell have all stalled at important technical areas. The bounce in bonds had a little bit of some, we'll call it some distance today, although we're not really out of the woods there yet. Gold and silver, nothing really bothers them. They're picking up off the lows. Energy comes back in, except for natural gas, which I suppose we missed an opportunity there, Thomas. But I've been trying to get filled on a position all day. We'll talk about what you're up to. And then yen intervention. What happened overnight? Ilya, I know that you've had your eyes on the Japanese yen. So we'll get to that in a little bit here. But as we kick things off here on this overtime, as we look to these final 56 minutes of the trading session here today, we see that the S&P 500 is up by about 0.35%, the NASDAQ 0.41. Your Russell is your leader, up by about 0.79%. Bonds are green on the day, up right around 0.84% for TLT. But Ilya, this is a market that, quite frankly, didn't really do anything today. Yeah, there's a little bit of an advance in the board, sure. But in terms of actual progress being made, I see us hanging out right around that 5140, 5170 here in ES. Mm-hmm. I see that we're still within the downtrend from the April swing highs. Yep. I see that we haven't cut through this technical wood. And quite frankly, with all the event risk ahead, who's to say that this would be the point in time that we do so? That's why last week and this week, the whole game plan was survival if you're a bull. And while we survived, this is now kind of the place where you've got to put up or shut up. Bears got to defend the line in the sand. Bulls got to push through it. We'll have some opportunities to play that game here the next few days with all these catalysts ahead. But this is a day where I don't think anyone should be surprised that the market didn't do much of anything at all. Why would you lay out significant new capital with all this risk right around the corner unless you have a very held strong conviction? As a trader, doesn't really make much sense. You're more or less just gambling.
I agree. I agree with all of that. I mean, I obviously laid my shorts back in the second half of last week after I took them off at the beginning of the week. The sell-off looked like it was running out of steam, so I took them off, booked them, booked my dollar longs, booked everything. At this point, I've reloaded on the queues with a put spread, reloaded on SPY with a put spread. Obviously, it was a little early, so I'm a little bit upside down on them now. But I completely agree that this is now decision time. This is either going to be the place where the correction in a down move runs aground and we turn back down, or we don't. And in my mind, it's the Fed that's going to set the pace for it. Even if you don't think that the Fed is going to do anything, obviously they're not going to do anything on rates. I think that much is a given. The question is going to be about guidance. But whether you think what they say matters or not, I think that's the key event risk for markets, even as just a waypoint in the timeline, where they'll say, okay, we're not going to get in front of this because who knows? And once it's out, we'll make a decision and go from there. We obviously also have NFP on Friday, which is going to be something the markets are likely to view through the Fed lens. And so it'll be the Fed, in my mind, still that matters, because however they tune the market's vision is how NFP will be assessed.
I think that's right. I mean, if the Fed comes out and says the next rate hike is going to be determined about whether or not the non-farm payrolls report beats the Bloomberg consensus forecast. Obviously, that's something they would never say. But if Powell were
how funny would that be?
But if Powell comes out and says, find the midpoint between the ICON, you know, the Refinitiv forecast and the Bloomberg consensus forecast. And if it's better than that, we're definitely hiking in June. If it's worse than that, then we're gonna cut in June. Right. Then everyone and their mother's gonna have their eyes on the non-farm payrolls report. If Powell says it doesn't really matter what happens to the labor market here henceforth, if it gets stronger, if it gets weaker, because we're focused squarely on inflation, non-farm payrolls could come and go on Friday and you may not even need a blink and you'll may not miss anything whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But these markets are waiting for that lens with which to view things. People thought it may have been the Meta earnings last week, and then you get Tesla and Google on the other side. But like in the S&P 500, you're not through 51, 40, 70. Here in the NASDAQ, Thomas, I see that we're back to the area where there was support for many weeks. End of February, all of March, first half of April, right around 18K. That 2134 EMA envelope, which was support from the rally at the end of last year, all the way up through April, we're now treating it as resistance. So here we are. This is kind of put up or shut up time. You don't have any directional bets, though, here, as you were mentioning on last call with Tom and Tony. What are your thoughts on something that's maybe a little bit more of a range-bound play? Because after all, if the range is up at 18,700 here in NQ, you think about the highs that we have in March, and the recent swing lows are closer to 17,100, then we're 800 points from both support and resistance effectively. I mean, there is a way to approach the market this week without feeling like you need to be a bull or a bear. While there's still a little bit of vol on the board, 38.9 IVR is not a ton, but it's something. Is that reasonable to you, Thomas?
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. Something I'm looking at more of a range-bound trade. I know you were talking to Iron Condors earlier. There's a good amount of vol in NQ to do that if you want. I'm kind of looking at more something like that along with gold, kind of with more of a little upside bias if I were to do it. But range-bound trading, I think the Fed will come and go. I think the jobs report will come and go. Our market's going to be waiting to make a move before that. I'd say it's probably the Fed that we're going to do that. We also got some earnings still. FactSet reporting that about 80% of earnings have been positive. So it makes sense that we're getting this upward move, you know, higher corporate earnings supporting that. But if jobs start to really reel in, and we're still seeing these high inflation or higher than expected inflation numbers, then I'm going to go drift more towards Ilya's camp on the short side. And I'm starting to see more, you know, obviously the merit of your argument at these price points rather than 2 weeks ago. And you were ahead on that call. I applaud you on that. But yeah, I'm a little less convicted, obviously, after this pullback, even though we are on an upward trend. But range bound trading, I think, makes sense. Can't really go too bullish here, in my opinion.
I mean, we are sitting right at the 1 month moving average right now, so it's not like we truly have done much of anything, you might say. You know, something has changed over the past week, Ilya, in terms of sentiment for how the market has digested earnings, which I think is a really mm-hmm. important tell.
Yeah.
Why I feel like if you, you know, you and I, we've been talking about this ever since the Ayatollah's birthday when Israel sent him those aid packages overnight that spooked the market and I started nibbling on the long side. I'm getting to the point where I'm starting to feel like, and I said, if we can survive this week and you give me like 5170 through the Fed and non-farm payrolls, mm-hmm. I'm going to feel a lot more confident. Because if we're at 5170, trading being a function of both price and time, 5170 yeah. puts you about here on your chart at the end of the week, which is outside of the downtrend from the April swing highs. It's back mm-hmm. above the 2134 EMA envelope. It's back above the head and shoulders neckline. But one thing that makes this rebound makes me feel a little bit better about it is how the market started to respond to earnings over the past week. Now, granted, I want to benchmark two figures here for people. And I wish I had this done visually, but we're going to have to do it just audio-wise here.
We'll do it live.
We'll do it live without any graphics. So sorry if it's difficult to follow along. And I understand that it may be in advance because it's a lot of numbers. Coming into last week, right, for the first quarter of 2024, the average stock that had a positive EPS surprise, it beat its earnings estimate, had seen a return of 0% in the 2 days before and the 2 days after their earnings release. Companies that were missing their earnings estimates, negative EPS surprises, in that same four-day window were losing on average 6.1%. Okay. That was worse on both accounts than the five-year average, which over the past 5 years, companies with positive EPS surprises during that four-day window have seen an average gain of 1%. And companies that have had negative EPS surprises for the 2 days before, 2 days after for that four-day window saw an average loss of 2.3%. Okay.
So markets got more sensitive to bad news is the headline there.
Exactly. So okay. good news coming into last week on aggregate for the first quarter mm-hmm. earnings, goods good reports were not being rewarded and bad reports were being punished a lot more than normal.
Right.
So we go through last week, we have all of the earnings reports come down the pipeline. We throw all that data into the mix and say, okay, based on the first quarter now, how are companies being treated that are beating or missing their earnings estimates? FactSet ran the numbers. They update this in their earnings insight report every Friday. It's an excellent thing that people should read every single Friday. It's completely free. Just Google earnings insight from FactSet. In aggregate now, the earnings responses were so positive last week that the average response for the first quarter is a 1% gain for that four-day window when you have a positive EPS beat, and the average loss is only 2.5%, which is remarkable because coming into last week, the average loss was over 6. So good reports last week were rewarded to such a degree, and even bad reports weren't punished, that the totality of the average performance for the entire quarter shifted back in line with the averages, which meant that the positive earnings reports last week were being rewarded way more than usual. And even the negative reports weren't even being punished. They were even being rewarded. Like a Tesla, for example, they had a terrible earnings report.
That's definitely the one that sticks out in my mind. Yeah.
But that's a fundamentally different sign of sentiment in the market that we saw throughout the month of April so far. Mm-hmm. April was good job, no reward. Bad job, here comes the switch. This time around, it's like candy for everyone. Here's a participant. Oh, you got your earnings report out? Participation trophy. Here's 2% gain for your stock. Oh, you not only handed in the project, but you got an A on it. Here's a 10% gain for your stock. So good news is great news right now. Bad news is not being treated as bad news, at least on the earnings front. And I think that's a really important development here, because if we can make it through our Apple and Amazon, if you can make it through your Fed meeting, and you can make it through your non-farm payrolls report, and the market hasn't cleared out the lows that we saw in April, and we're just hanging around here, 5150, and even better yet, north of 5170, I don't think the bears have a prayer then. They've fired every single bullet. And then I think you need something new to appear on the scene. We've benchmarked the geopolitical risk. We've benchmarked the interest rate risk in the short term. This is the put up or shut up week. Otherwise, people like me are going to stand around and say, this was the best you've got. We're 2% away from the all-time highs. I've got this lousy t-shirt and a few weeks of piss poor returns that have since been negated. Why wouldn't I feel better about trying to push this market higher once again? So I think this is if bears want this market still, like you said, this is either a low and this has been the correction and we're now gearing up for the next leg lower, or this was the correction and this is the delineating line in the sand for the next 200 points in ES. Either we're going back to the highs or going back below 49.63.
Yeah.
That's how I see it.
That is a very compelling argument. And I completely get it. And it could totally be correct. I see this as reasonable. It is a sentiment shift. Yes. Here is where you lose me. Not necessarily lose me in the sense that I think it's wrong. No, I think it's a completely plausible perspective. Here is the fly in the ointment in that argument for me. When you look at the way that markets were behaving before April's kind of more volatile earnings evolution, as you've just described, right? That they were more sensitive and then not. And the averages have since shifted after last week's pivot. The previous period, let's call it the first quarter in aggregate, what were stocks doing? They were going up. So although you were seeing this situation where everybody was punishing bad news, stocks were still finding a way higher. And so what this might be more indicative of, if you look at a sort of a different way to interpret that same evolution in sentiment, is the first quarter, and you've made this point very astutely. The first quarter, everything was climbing the wall of worry. there were all these things. People were so negative. Oh, there's a credit crisis that's coming, and eventually the rate cuts are going to kill us all, and blah, 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 blah. Right? There was all this negativity. Everybody was really bearish. And stocks were rallying in everyone's face. That people are getting more optimistic now, maybe the sentiment shift that actually gets the bear market to continue going. This may be the capitulation into which everybody sells. So, yes, there is a sentiment extreme here that may have turned. I'm not quite sure which way it's turned.
Well, no, I think I'm on that same page here. Like, I got to see some conditions met to get really bulled up. I look at the Russell right now, the swing low that we have back on March 19th, you know, very much intersecting in the middle of that 2134 EMA envelope, just like with the S&P and the NASDAQ, instrumental as support here in recent weeks and months, flipping over and becoming resistance, right with that former swing low from March 19th. We're not ready to commit to a breakout just yet, which means if you're a short-term trader here, I mean, quite frankly, you put your chips on the table. Where's the risk? Do you want to get long into resistance right now, or do you want to take a short against basically the high of the day? So that's kind of why, if you're a short-term trader, given the fact that everything needs to be perfect, and up until last week for companies reporting earnings, everything needed to be perfect for them to even just get a pass where their stock wasn't punished. Maybe that's still at the fringe. Right. So I want to see 2040 here in the Russell. I want to see NASDAQ 18K. I want to see S&P 500 5170. And I want to see those numbers on Friday, not intraday tomorrow. Right? I want to see those on the close on Friday to start feeling a lot better about things. Thomas, are you, I know you and me were both on the bull side a lot more together, you know, earlier this year. We've had the correction. Are you viewing this week as someone who is predominantly bullish as such a test the way that I am, psychologically speaking, right? Because it's like, if this is the best you've got, this is the biggest, you can only take us 2% off the highs, right? Like, so why would, how are you seeing things? Because Ilya and I clearly are close, but not on the same page.
Yeah, I'm kind of taking it as a moment to reassess, letting it shake out. You know, I want to trade the trend. I can predict either way it goes up or down, but until we get back in this trend, specifically trading the NASDAQ, which has been my primary vehicle, I'm probably going to sit on my hands a little bit. I might take small positions here and there until we get on the NQ back somewhere around. I'd like to see us go above 18.2, really, at least get back in that range that we were trading earlier in the summer or earlier this year. I've been seeing some people throw around the sell in May and go away thing. I don't really think that applies when you look at the data from the past 5-10 years. So yeah, I'm just waiting until the trend.
Sure, it applies. Period.
I'll start trading.
Sell in May.
I'm not sure it applies. Period. I get immediately suspicious of rhyming couplets as a trading strategy.
No, but sell in May and go, let's say that is real thing. Is that something as a trader you should be concerned with? No, because you're not an investor. That's an investing axiom, not a trading one. But even as an investing axiom, it's something that people who want to own more stocks say to dumb people to get those dumb people to sell them the stocks because the market historically rallies in May, June, and July. And so the expression should be sell in May, no, buy through July, yes. It just bothers me because it's like this is something that financial media perpetuates.
Yes.
Because like you said, it just rhymes. So like, let's talk about it endlessly here, even though if you've been doing that for the past 15 or 20 years, you've been leaving money on the table. If you want to sell for a calendar reason, sell on July 31st and buy back after Rosh Hashanah. Otherwise, seasonally, there's no reason to not be long any other time of the year ever when the market's
I just don't see it May as this kind of incredible pivot. It's just not that consistent.
Yeah, right. So in any event, Thomas, 18K, right? Easy to say that former support end of February, March, going into April, get through there. You're back in a former trading range. You feel a little bit better about it. Beyond that, what else is there to say about stocks? I mean, Ilya, this is the conversation we had on Futures Power Hour on Friday. It's the same exact thing we had on Futures Power Hour today, which is to say that you're at the technical crossroads.
Yeah.
And you haven't needed to see a push through them yet because the market's gotten us back to the clear decision line in the middle of ranges over the past several months. And if we're going to the top side or the bottom side of those ranges, probably hinges upon what the earnings and the Fed and the data say in the coming days. We're not here to make predictions. We know what we think may happen. How the market responds is a different story. We can only trade what we see in front of us here. Ilya, though, I do want to pivot us into the sector performance earlier than normal, because on Mondays here on Overtime from now on, we have this new off the charts research piece that we do. We get all this sell side, buy side research sent to us over the course of the week. And I pick out a few things that I come across from Twitter and what have you. And there's five charts in there that I think you guys would be interested in discussing and looking at. And I think the audience would be interested in hearing your opinions on. I do want to go over to the sectors here for today's performance. Overall, as you can imagine, on a green day, most things are up. 21 of the 25 that we follow here on Overtime are in green territory. The big loser is the regional banking ETF. A bank went down, was seized on Friday night. And so not necessarily a surprise. There's some weakness coming out of KRE, off by 0.87%, but obviously not a significantly huge down move. Is it helping the madman out of the money KRE put? Yes. Is it doing anything substantial to help it? No, it's just not hurting it anymore. Beyond that, consumer discretionary with Tesla jumping as much as it did leads the way higher. Ilya, this is a trade that I actually jumped out of today, apparently early, because I got out when it was trading at 186. This short put spread that I had put on a few weeks back, I decided to get out and put in an order, and that's where I was filled at 186. So I was able to turn what was a $12 loss on the spread turned into like a $2.40 profit. I'll take that, you know, sizable loser into a meaningful winner any day of the week. What's going on with this? I mean, I guess we will just start here with Tesla for both of you. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's all PR. What has actually changed for Tesla? You know, are they going to own the data that they're getting out of China?
They're apparently allowed to sell in China again after His Majesty went and had a meeting with mainland officials. I don't know that this fundamentally changes anything, because the main issue with China is that if you look at the macro data, there is no demand in China. The past four quarters have seen real GDP run above nominal GDP. Now, what does that tell you? Nominal GDP is supposed to be real minus inflation. If real is above that, that means inflation's negative. There is, for the past four quarters, a deflationary coefficient of about 1.5-ish percentage points of GDP in China. That's awful. That's a total absence of demand. And you're seeing it in the parallel decline in exports and imports. You're seeing it in all kinds of other soft data numbers. So, okay, you're now allowed to sell in China. La-di-da, who's buying?
Thomas, do you have any interest in Tesla here? Go. Because I see a 194.05 chart with a market that's in a bit of a bullish falling wedge. It may go back up to the March swing highs north of 200. Do you have anything on the board for Tesla or any interest in trading this? Because this has been a sharp turnaround from 140.
Yeah, I mean, that previous gap, it looks like it already kind of closed. Maybe with the IV, maybe selling a call spread up around 200 if it goes up. But I think Ilya is right. Tesla in China, too many competitors. The competitors are already priced lower than Tesla.
Right.
So unless, and you know, there's also this argument that Tesla is going to solve the problem of full, you know, true autonomous driving. 5 years ago, that argument was a lot stronger. Today, so many companies are very close to that mark, and I don't really think they command much premium for that argument anymore. So yeah, I'd let it drift up a little bit more. Think about selling something, a call spread 200, 205, something around there. But probably not going to trade it.
Both Apple and Tesla, two of the dogs of the market, the Fab 7 members who have been the terrible two, Both get a nice little bounce here today, but XLY, the consumer discretionary ETF, your leader, up 2.33%. Not something that you usually see lead to the upside in a bear market, Ilya. I don't see anything else here on the board particularly of note. Gold miners up 0.55%. I guess we can talk about precious metals a little bit before we hop on over to this off the charts piece. Gold and silver really shaping up nicely against their 1 month moving averages the past few days. We got that pullback last week. I was looking at the positioning data from the CFTC's COT report today. Even with the pullback last week, people added to their net long gold positions, and we're still not at the most net long level of the year for gold. So there's clearly substantial room for people to come in. Maybe that's a function of, you know,
maybe people want to get on China's coattails here.
Well, that's actually, it feels like we prepared something for this a little bit.
Maybe that's
one of the things that I wanted to discuss on Off the Charts, which is the whole reason I was turning into gold and silver in the first place, Ilya. But we can start early.
After you and I have been doing this together for a decade and a half, there is some synergy.
So there's two things I wanted to talk about here from the gold perspective. Obviously, besides the fact that we're continuing to pick up against these technical support levels, I know Tom yesterday was saying with you guys on first call, he thought it was a dead trade because CME's changing the margins. How about a different fundamental angle here? We see that there's been an explosion in Chinese gold trading.
Yeah.
This comes from the Simon White, Bloomberg macro strategist. He says, quote, the yuan has been steadily falling versus the dollar this year. So far, the decline has been measured, but activity in commodities has prompted conjecture that China is about to orchestrate a significant one-off yuan devaluation. Futures gold trading in China has moved sharply higher and the net long position has been rising. Ilya, you keep saying that there is a tailwind from the Chinese central bank helping support. And you can see that in the data. You can look at the FX reserves figures and China's been buying a lot of gold. Granted, the amount of gold that they own relative to their overall FX reserves is well below the amount of gold that the United States owns, for example, relative to its FX reserves. So just like China stepping its toes into the academic waters of talking about what QE would look like as administered by the PBOC, accumulating gold reserves is one of those things that developing central banks do to become a developed economy central bank. It's not out of character, but
it's
the scope
space
and scale,
for them that stand out, not
exactly. It's the scope and scale, which not necessarily that they're doing it. It's how quickly it's occurring.
Yes,
and the context in which it's occurring that's giving people causing some eyebrows to raise here. And so I know that you think that gold and silver have a tailwind to them. I guess we can go back to the charts here. Vol has come back in very, very quickly. We're at 64.2 IV and GC in SI and 4. It's now back at 40.6, cut in half from the highs of where it was it was over 100. But now we're back at these 1 month moving averages. Are you on board this let's buy dips in precious metals? Because there's something else going on here in the macro world that really we should be paying attention to, and it's China and Chinese gold buying, if on a retail level for devaluation hedges or on a reserve level for the PBOC just maturing.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should be on the lookout. I don't think we're quite through the corrective period yet, or at least it's not obvious that we are. So if you look at the way silver looks, the way gold looks, they both look exactly the same. Last week, Israel and Iran escalation closes the loop. You get a one-off revision lower on both of them. There's just a step down where markets basically say, right, they're done here. Loop closed. That's it. Next page. And so you get a one-day down leg in both. And I think the reason you get only a one-day down leg and not a more broad sell-off was because it is China that's the main catalyst here, and not geopolitics, and clearly not interest rates and the Fed, which would be the normal catalyst for gold, because it's been going up all year, and interest rates have been going up all year, and Fed rate cut odds have been falling away all year, which is not what you'd expect. As a matter of fact, for the first time in over a decade, gold has decoupled from GLD ETF holdings. So you can very clearly see like where your garden variety investors are going. Rates are going up. The dollar is up since the beginning of the year. Why in the world would I buy gold? Yet it's going up. So GLD holdings aren't swelling. So investors aren't really buying. You can see that in the COT report chart that you just showed. Positioning is not that heady. And so what's the thing that stands out? China is accumulating gold reserves at a clip of 11% year on year, which is wild. So you look at that and you go, okay, you get a one leg lower because geopolitics has happened and the market goes, right, okay, let's tick that off. Now what? It hasn't found ongoing momentum though. Since that one revision, it's crickets in these markets. So I think maybe my suspicion has been this might carry out as far as June, but we'll see what happens with this Fed announcement this week. I think there is a possibility that you get another kind of revision lower with this week's FOMC, and maybe we'll have to wait till June's FOMC to kind of squeeze all of that out, because in June we'll get the update of the summary of economic projections, and that's where the Fed is going to have to really put up or shut up on what they're forecasting and whether they're going to back off the three cut thing that they reinforced in March, which of course has given us the sell-off, in my opinion, that we've since seen, where the market said, oh, you think three and we think one? Yeah, you're way off. Sell risk, because this is still an adjustment that you'll have to make. You're still going to have to cop to all of this. The same way, by the way, that the market was running up risk in the first quarter because they were more dovish than the Fed, screaming at the Fed, yeah, you're wrong. It's not going to be three. It's going to be four or five. You're going to have to cop to this risk on, right? Markets are obviously baking in things, not because they think that they're wrong. It's because they think that they're right. And so I still think there is a risk here that the Fed comes out, let's say this week, and perhaps in June when they actually have to move the forecast, and say, it's not that we're saying we're going to hike, but the door is open to basically saying no cuts. We're going to take the glide toward automatic cutting this year off the table. And maybe they won't. But the mantra from them has been basically since November, we're going to cut to some extent in 2024. The market now gives them a gentleman's nod of a hat and says, okay, you do it once because you said. Now, if the Fed comes out and says, yeah, maybe there's much more two-way risk here, maybe we're not nearly as autopilot on these cuts as we've been intimating, that would be a change. That would mean the markets are 29 basis points in the wrong direction.
When was the last time the Fed hiked after pausing a hiking cycle?
All right.
The bar is they should hike. I think they should hike. If I were them, I would hike this week. The bar is very high for them to hike if you look at historically after they stop
hiking. It's very high. But really all they have to do is talk it. Right. We remember
they've talked it. We've got a 50 basis point rise in yield since the March Fed meeting.
Right.
They've done the talking.
Right. And the markets are still baking in 29 basis points for the year, which means they get one cut because they've said. And at this point,
but doesn't that make sense though? If we were pricing in 75 basis points back in March.
Yeah.
And the Fed's March update was three cuts.
Yeah,
and the market and the Fed's been slowly shifting us between Powell and Williams, and if you can forget Kashkari, but like we've heard, hikes are possible, no cuts this year are possible. So now we're at 29 basis points, 10-year yield, 5-year yield, right? Those are up 50 basis points from where they're in March.
Mm-hmm.
As the market's gone from 75 down to 29, so it all kind of matches up, right? Like
to get us further from here,
the Fed's got to say no cuts are possible. They have to eliminate the possibility of a cut.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
And they're not going to do that on May 1st when you have 6 months of data before you even think about you have the April, May, June, July, August, and then September figures before you get the September FOMC SEP. I mean, they don't have to do that. Maybe they take it off in June.
I think all they have to do is say we're not on autopilot.
But they But you know, I think they could say that and sound hawkish, and Powell could come out and be like, "Well, we've always said we've been data dependent. Have you been listening to us for years?"
Totally. Well, so. And he would be right. But the markets don't interpret. But the markets don't interpret the Fed that way, right? This is the perpetual kind of give and take between the Fed comes out and gives you a 2-year view, and the markets go, "Oh my God, they've changed everything." No, they're on a different timeline than you. They're not nearly jumping around as much. I think that's really it. Is the Fed would have to come out and basically say, in order to do anything hawkish, right? In order for the market to take it as hawkish, between the statement and the Powell Q&A, they have to walk away saying there is a level of two-way risk that we weren't baking in before that there is here now. That basically, after the Fed's been spending all this time saying, we think the path of least resistance is we're going to cut, to the Fed now saying, we don't know what the path of least resistance is. And that's it.
Thomas, we've been talking about gold and silver here. I'm curious as to whether or not you believe the outflows from USO are a sign that the move in oil is finished. Last week, we had a record outflow from U.S. oil, the world's largest oil ETF. Alex Longley at Bloomberg says U.S. oil fund, the biggest oil ETF, posted its largest daily outflow on record as crude prices lose some of the geopolitical premium that was built in from tensions between Iran and Israel. The withdrawal of $376 million was bigger than the previous record of $323 million set in 2009. It followed 2 days of similarly large inflows in the two prior sessions. Thomas, I looked at the charts. The last time we saw a daily outflow to this degree at the previous record was the first week of January 2009, which marked the lows for oil for the rest of the year. I have no compelling directional feeling on oil, although I think the floor has been raised. Growth is higher, and the fact that Iran and Israel are directly lobbing bombs at one another is a different dimension than we have seen in this conflict previously. I also see oil here as putting in a potential evening star candlestick cluster up against that September 2023 high, an area that was support all throughout April. So on one hand, the outflows tell me we've reached an exhaustion point in terms of selling. On the other hand, the technicals don't really look that appealing as a long. Volatility is almost nothing here. It's really 20.5 is not that appealing in oil for an IVR. What's your take on oil right now? How should people be approaching this?
For the outflows in USO, I mean, that is a compelling headline or, you know, impactful. I think a lot of that's profit taking after the run up from the lows we saw in January, December. I don't think you should really look into it more than that, just profit taking, some resetting. But this came alongside some changing undertones in the fuels market. Things like gasoline, diesel, we're starting to see, especially going into summer, instead of demand increasing, we're now seeing it kind of flatline to drop. Those stockpiles are raising the past few EIA API reports. You know, at the same time, OPEC, they continue to say they're cutting or stepping up enforcement for these cuts. If you look at export numbers out of places like Russia and things like that, there's some pullback there. It's not too much. So I think the story, the long bull story for crude oil is kind of taking a break for now. I could definitely see range bound trading 80 to 84. I've been saying that for probably a month now. I think that's probably the range we'll stay in. I don't think you get a significant pullback, at least until the whole Middle East crisis or tensions, whatever you want to call it, kind of subsides to a point where, you know, those are cooled and you take those premiums. Any chance of those oil flows out of the Red Sea and things like that being completely taken off the table. So sideways trading for now. And like you said, the technicals not really compelling either way, I don't think.
Ilya, what's your take on oil? I know 2 weeks ago we were talking about how the weekly chart as shown here on the screen was giving us a potential evening star candlestick pattern. We were failing below the September uptrend. We were starting to creep below the downtrend from the June and September, or rather June 22 and September 23 highs. And yet last week we bounced. Thus far, it's an inside week. It's just Monday. We're not going to think too much about the weekly candle just yet. But it feels like there's cases to be made on both sides here. Technically, I know fundamentally maybe you're not as supportive, but why not? If China's buying copper and iron ore and nickel and gold and silver, and they're accumulating all of these commodities, why wouldn't they also be buying crude oil? Why can't crude oil be part of that story where China is getting ready for a devaluation of the yuan, knowing that when they want to buy things and import things from abroad in the near future is going to cost 10% more, 20% more overnight? Mm-hmm. Why not accumulate all of those commodities right now? Why can't oil be benefiting from that tailwind the way that gold or copper has been?
I'm not saying it can't be. I'm saying if you look at a daily chart here, there's no suggestion that it is. And that, I think, is key, right? At the end of the day, the price action has to show it. It's not actionable for me. I mean, there's all kinds of plausible macro narratives, all kinds. I don't think that, by the way, Russia and China's relationship here makes it necessary for China to accumulate oil, because they don't need to be going out into the open market and buying expensive oil when they could be buying cheap sanctioned oil from Russia, which is what they've been doing. And so I don't think there is this kind of motivation there that there would be for, let's say, copper. Russia is not the world's biggest copper producer. It's certainly a big metals producer. But when you look at the dynamics of oil, I mean, at this point, China is Russia's biggest export market, and it's because they're the only ones willing to buy this kind of volume of oil, and they're buying it at tremendous discount because beggars can't be choosers. And if you're Moscow, you got to sell this stuff lest you lose the Ukraine momentum that you've managed to kind of reinvigorate while the U.S. was fumbling around with $8. Now, $8 have now been passed. So now Russia really needs to sell a bunch of cheap oil. Because if they're going to try to keep this slight momentum, and by the way, it hasn't been all that much momentum. Ukraine has impressively held up without the aid, although they were getting pretty lean there in recent months. Now that the aid has been approved, they have firepower for, and Thomas, you're way more steeped in this than I am. But from what I can kind of surmise, looking at various estimates out there, they're good on ammo and other inputs for a good year at this point, after this latest round of aid. So it seems like if you're Russia, you've got to sell as much cheap oil as you can, because you need to retool in a hurry. So it seems like that's probably not as big of a thing here for China to go into the open market and accumulate. I actually suspect their accumulation of gold might very well be linked to something like settling bilateral transactions with Russia in a way that doesn't touch the SWIFT US dollar system. And I think they're attempting to kind of back that system with gold. It's not that much. Their bilateral trade last year was $240 billion. Now compare that to what, 7-8 trillion that's settled in USD every day? This is not a competitor to the US dollar, so let's just take that argument immediately off the table. But it is something that they could be accumulating gold for. So maybe that's a consideration for that, but probably not for this. So for me, I see it testing the underside of the range where it held before. That's not, and struggling there. So that's not a confirmed bullish case for me. It's also not a confirmed bearish case because it's now toward the bottom of its next digestion range, somewhere above 82-ish. And so if you look at that, you go, okay, well, the risk reward here is shot either way. Either this thing is going to have to break up or down. But do a thing and then I'll be interested.
Yeah, I've been sizing up. I put in an order this morning. I've tried to get in both on the long call spread side and the short put spread spread in natural gas. The rally up here a little bit today, so vol come out of the market now below, down below 19.8 IVR. Thomas, I see a break of the downtrend here from the November, the January swing highs. We're trying to get together a little bit of a bottom. I would note the price action here in natural gas is really similar to what we saw this time last year, last March. Rally at the start of the month, then a big collapse into that sideways shuffle here over the next few weeks. What do we have here? Beginning of March, a rally to start the month, then the collapse and into the sideways shuffle for a few weeks. So upon reconsideration of thinking that we're going into a similar type of environment technically as we were last year through the spring, being long a call spread may not be fortuitous because we may not actually rally. I'd much rather be short the put spread. So I'm trying to lay into a 170, 190 short put spread right now. I haven't been able to get filled yet. I don't think I'm going to with 11 minutes left in the trading day, but I think it's reasonable because it's uncorrelated to everything else, right? Do you think that natural gas is going to be reacting to the Fed or non-farm payrolls or Amazon or Apple earnings over the next few days? No, it never does. It's its own animal. So adding something into the mix of trades for me that brings some diversification makes a good deal of sense because I am leaning a little bit, you know, one way, short the Russell puts, long the S&P 500 calls, short the 6E puts, much to Ilya's chagrin. but all that is kind of on the same track. So I need to make some position adjustments ahead of all these events. And anyway, Thomas, how are you feeling about natural gas? I know that you said you're looking long in here.
Yeah, I was thinking long this weekend until, you know, I checked the charts and it shot up ahead of my positioning. So I'm going to wait till it gets back down around the 1.9. Like you point out, that's been a really good point to buy going all the way back to earlier this year. I don't like it long right here, although, you know, the trend is broken. And I'm sure both of you have seen the longer term story for natural gas is getting a lot more bullish with artificial intelligence. A lot of banks are updating their forecast the past couple weeks on this story that AI is going to drive energy consumption 9 times what it was from the internet over the next 5 to 10 years. So that's a really convincing story. You got the LNG plant. I forgot which one it was. I think it's one. It's one of Freeport's. They're running like 70% of their available capacity for the past few months now. They have some problem with one of their export terminals that they can't seem to figure out. So you know that natural gas not coming out of the U.S., you can actually see that as bearish for U.S. prices since they can't convert that natural gas into LNG and export it. Maybe a bullish play on European natural gas, although I'm not sure of a route to directly make a play on that. So
can't do that here. No. Not on this chart.
No. So yeah, just thought I'm gonna wait till it falls back around 1.9, then take a stab at a long position.
Guys, as we wrap this up, I want to pull us into the last three charts here on off the charts, which are all for the bulls. And I say that because we've seen a lot of things happen in recent days and weeks that make you think that we hit a capitulation point 2 weeks ago. Forget the fact that the S&P 500 hit the head and shoulders target and started to bounce, and that it occurred alongside of a catalyst, which was the Israel response to Iran that Thursday evening going into Friday. Mm-hmm. This is from JP Morgan's Positioning Intelligence. I found it on Twitter via David Marlin, who is the CEO of Marlin Capital. I'm assuming he's the founder because his last name is Marlin and the firm's name is Marlin. Either way, thank you at Marlin_Capital for finding this chart. The 4-week change Z-score, rescaled versus the S&P 500. When we're looking at hedge funds, retail asset managers, CTAs, and ETF flows, the 4-week decrease in positioning reached the most extreme level since the October 2023 low. Talking about evidence of this being a potential low or the low, a low versus the low in the market. The AAII bull bear spread actually dips below negative into negative territory, now negative 1.8%. It's the most negative sentiment's been in the market since the first week of November 2023. And finally, a chart that we've talked about, or stats that we've talked about a lot recently from Wayne Whaley, the Dow theorist over on Twitter. When we look at the forward returns for the S&P 500, historically speaking, when you have 5 months green followed by a 6 month that is red, what happens thereafter? 30 other times in history this has occurred. 1 month later, the market is higher 73% of the time. 3 months later, it's higher 83% of the time. 6 months higher 90% of the time. And then 12 months later, it's higher 80% of the time. The returns go from about 1.8% all the way up to 10.2%. The point is, when we look at where we're bouncing from and we're talking about the key technical thresholds that we're trying to clear this week, should we clear them? You have a lot of evidence on your side if you're a bull right now that a return to the yearly highs feels like that should at least be on deck. Whether or not we clear them is another story, but if we're talking about where the next 200 points are in ES, I find it very compelling to think that they're probably going to be the upside here henceforth. So give me 5170 at the end of this week, Ilya, and I'll feel a lot better about ES. On the flip side of it is, if we can't take advantage of the fact that the sentiment isn't overbought anymore and the positioning has been cleared out, and if we can't get to 5170 this week, I think ES has a date with 4963 very soon. And if you're at 4963, who's to say that we shouldn't be going even deeper? Because then the prospect of no Fed cuts this year, maybe that actually does matter for these equity markets. Mm-hmm. I have no compelling case to be long or to put on a long or short trade right now, Mr. Spivak. I think this is a horrible entry point for people. Plain and simple. It's a coin flip. Can go either way. So if you've been long, you stay long. If you've been short, depending upon where you entered, maybe you're staying short. Otherwise, neutrality, probably the best bet.
I agree. I'm short basically on the grounds that the trend appears to be down. We've had a correction. We're at the deciding line, and I have it on because the trend is the trend. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. But we're at the deciding line here. This is, I would not be getting too excited one way or another. We're going to make some kind of a convincing move here, and it will be what it is. I think it'll be down because the trend is down. And so I have it on as ever in a very risk-defined spreads kind of way, strictly because, as you've said, and I agree with, uptrends are stair steps up, down moves are elevators down. I don't want to miss it. And so I'm willing to be a little bit more aggressive with getting on ahead of confirmation than I would be, let's say, in currency markets, which are much more a two-way market. But I don't see a strong case to be made here one way or another until there is something directional that actually occurs.
Something directional has not occurred just yet, Thomas. I know that you're in waiting mode here. If 18K is a level for you in the NASDAQ and maybe 5170 here is in the S&P, let's just, it's Friday morning, non-farm payrolls come out. It does its usual thing where if it rallies for the first 30 minutes, it falls back thereafter. Or if it falls for the first 30 minutes, it rallies back thereafter. You never trust the first move ever for non-farm payrolls. But let's say we're looking at a market on Friday that's 5147. What are you doing? And you can't use the cop out that I would use here, which is to say that you don't place trades on Friday.
Well, I usually don't. but I mean, the longer we stay below 5,200 on the ES, the less bullish I'll be getting. So if we linger under it for more than a week, I'll start looking at a short. Breaking levels, above 5,200, I'll get long, or thinking about getting long. Below 5,000, I'd get short.
You know what? I think that's the most important takeaway for people here. Forget the noise this week. We're going to bloviate a lot about it because that's what we get paid to do. But as a trader, I think you actually have some pretty clear levels to work with here. If we're above 5170, you can look higher. And if by the end of this week, we can't get through there, then you look lower. And where's higher? 5333 and a half, the yearly high. You're thinking about that level. You're moving into the top side of the range. And if you can't and you start failing back here, you start thinking about the support, the low point of the range, 49.63.5. And that's really it. It just becomes a game of where's the closest high, where's the nearest low, which way is momentum pointing in the short term? How can we get there? Where's the path of least resistance? Right now, the path of least resistance off of completing technical moves a week and a half ago was higher. We got the vol contraction. The easy part of the bold move is over. Was that the dip to buy? The data suggests it may be. The price action, not yet. There's still a few bridges to cross here in the coming days. And we'll find out more, of course, over these next few days. And we're not going to find it out today, of course, because today overtime is now out of time. We'll be back same time tomorrow, every Monday through Thursday, 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 Central here on Tasty Live. For Ilya Spivak, the man in orange, and Thomas Westwater, today's man in blue, I've been Chris Vecchio. Good luck trading. After a brief break, Tasty Live will be back. Nighttime programming continues next with Ilya Spivak and Macro Money.
See you there, folks.
The content of this podcast is created, produced, and provided solely by Tasty Live, Inc. and does not represent the direct views or opinions of any of its affiliated companies. This content is for informational and educational purposes only. It is not, nor is it intended to be, trading or investment advice or a recommendation that any security, futures contract, digital asset, other product, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any person. Trading securities, futures products, and digital assets involve risk and may result in a loss greater than the original amount invested. Tasty Live Inc., through its content, financial programming, or otherwise, does not provide investment or financial advice or make investment recommendations. The information provided may not be appropriate for all investors and is provided without respect to individual investor financial sophistication, financial situation, investing time horizon, or risk tolerance. Tasty Live Inc. is not a licensed financial advisor, registered investment advisor, registered broker-dealer, or registered introducing broker.